This week, a South African runner had what should have been a red-letter day for any athlete. Caster Semenya outran her competition in the women's 800 meters by more than 2 seconds at the World Championships. But her victory is clouded by questions about her gender. An investigation has been launched. Skeptics say her deep voice and her appearance indicate that she is a man. South African politicians and her family insist that she is a woman. NPR's Allison Keyes has the story.
The organization that governs the championship says it will take weeks to get results of tests currently underway to verify Semenya's gender after what it calls remarkable improvements in her performance in recent months. Her time in the race, 1 minute 55.45 seconds, was more than 8 seconds faster than her time last October when she won the Commonwealth Youth Games.
Semenya is away and gone, looked behind, has got the gold medal sewn up in the bag. All of the controversy put behind her.
Despite the announcer's enthusiasm, that performance did anything but end the controversy. The 18-year-old Semenya didn't appear at a press conference following the race. In her place was Pierre Weiss, general secretary of the International Association of Athletics Federations. He acknowledged the storm of questions about her gender.
There is doubt about the fact that this person is a lady, is a woman, but today there is no proof. And the benefit of doubt must always be in favor of the athletes.
In a statement today, IAAF spokesman Nick Davies said that the gender testing does not suggest any suspicion of deliberate misconduct, but is aimed at assessing the possibility of a potential medical condition that would give Semenya an unfair advantage over her competitors. Though Davies goes on to note that further speculation may only be harmful to the athlete and her family, it seems to some the damage is already done. The internet is rife with comments on both sides of the issue, and it's also a hot topic in Semenya's homeland. South African resident Pierre Venter in Johannesburg echoes many of the blogs.
I understand the kind of worry about it. If she is a she does look very manly.
But Johannesburg resident Samantha Monyela thinks the critics are wrong.
They should just go by her word. I mean, she wouldn't ethically do something that was against the rules.
Gold medal sprinter Michael Johnson told the BBC he thinks the IAAF did Semenya a disservice by speaking about the testing before she ran her final.
I would have much preferred to have heard about this as a rumor and something that we didn't know if it's going to happen or not, so therefore we're not now debating it and talking about it and potentially embarrassing this athlete for the rest of her life.
Sports federations, including the IAAF, used to perform chromosome tests, but stopped years ago partly because such screening isn't conclusive. Exams involving a mouth swab to determine if a person had two X chromosomes and is therefore female didn't allow for the fact that some people with X and Y chromosomes do not therefore become male. There are also cases of people who are genetically male but develop female characteristics. Current IAAF gender verification policy involves a medical evaluation before a panel including a gynecologist, endocrinologist, psychologist, internal medicine specialist, and an expert on gender. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Quentin Tarantino's seventh feature, Inglourious Basterds, sixth if you count both parts of Kill Bill as one movie, borrows and cheekily misspells the title of a 1978 war film. The resemblances end there. The new film stars Brad Pitt as the leader of a vigilante squad, killing Nazis in gory fashion in occupied France. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Quentin Tarantino often caricatures himself. Interviewed in a rollicking documentary about Australian exploitation movies, Not Quite Hollywood, he describes a female revenge flick in which a half-naked woman is tied to the front of a car. If you like outrageous cinema, he babbles, you live and breathe for this. You're going, who the bleep thought of that? That is, of course, the cry he wants to elicit from us watching his films. But if such provocations were his only motive, Tarantino wouldn't be a major director. His World War II revenge fantasia, Inglourious Basterds, set in German-occupied France, is certainly a collection of who-the-bleep-thought-of-that set pieces, but it's also a switchback journey through his twisted inner landscape, where movies and history, misogyny, misogyny and feminism, sadism and romanticism collide and create bizarre new hybrids. The movie is an ungainly pastiche, yet on some whacked-out level, it's organic. The overture is stunning. To the twang of Ennio Morricone spaghetti western music, a French farmer watches a jeep filled with Nazi soldiers travel the long road to his farm. Close-ups of his anxious face alternate with long shots of the car coming nearer in a way that compares to both Hitchcock and Sergio Leone. What follows is an excessively, unnervingly polite interrogation over the farmer's kitchen table by Nazi hunter Hans Landa, played by an elegant and insinuating actor named Christoph Waltz. To watch Landa slowly move in for the kill in a protracted shot of both men is to understand that Tarantino, for all his infamous gore, is at his best in drawn-out dialogues humming with subtext that precede the carnage. Inglourious Basterds has two major strands and many minor ones. The most emotional part of the film centers on Melanie Laurent's Shoshana Dreyfus, a Jew who escaped from that farm and forges a new identity running a Paris cinema. The other half follows the title brigade, the Bastards for short, American Jews led by non-Jew, part Apache Southerner Aldo Rain, played by Brad Pitt, puffing out his jaw to look like Brando. The Bastards are famous for scalping or beating in the brains of Nazis. Sure, it never happened, but watching Pitt's Rain taunt a prostrate commandant, you so wish it had.
I assume you know who we are.
Your elder, the Apache.
But Warren, if you heard of us, you probably heard we ain't in the prisoner-taking business. We in the killing Nazi business. And cousin, businesses are booming.
Oh, yeah.
That leaves two ways we can play this out. Either kill you or let you go. Up the road a piece, there's an orchard. Besides you, we know there's another crop patrol f***ing around here somewhere. If that patrol were to have any crack shots, that orchard would be a goddamn sniper's delight. So if you ever want to eat a sauerkraut sandwich again, you gotta show me on this here map where they are. You gotta tell me how many they are, and you gotta tell me what kind of artillery they're carrying with them.
I won't attempt to diagram the narrative, which is full of digressions that are more fun than the main line, but I'll say that Inglourious Basterds builds to a chaotic climax in a cinema in which Shoshana schemes to blow up top Nazi brass at the premiere of a Goebbels-produced propaganda epic starring a real-life Nazi hero, a blue-eyed young Aryan who happens to be wooing her, unaware she's a Jewess. But I'm afraid on the level of pure staging, Tarantino isn't up to the phantasmagorical climax. It feels choppy and labored, and both the action and Pitt's performance drift into camp. One problem is Inglourious Basterds peaks half an hour earlier in a beer cellar full of Nazis when a British agent and film scholar, played by Michael Fassbender, and two of the Basterds meet with a gorgeous German movie star, played by Diane Kruger, working undercover. The scene goes on and on and on, endlessly digressive, so that you're both laughing and on the brink of screaming with dread. It's that, not the bloody scalpings and splatter, that make you say, "Who the bleep thought of that?" The answer, of course, is someone who believes that myth can trump history, who says no furor can survive the onslaught of a world exploitation cinema auteur.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
No.
can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
What happened when you were 16?
That's probably the most difficult question it is for me to answer, even though it might be the question that I'm asked most often. But I'll just say, when I was 16 years old, I was stuck in between two worlds. And it was the streets, and it was school. And for some reason, I thought that I could straddle the line and still find a way to make it to college. Mm-hmm. But the reality was just different, and I was impulsive just like any other 16-year-old. So one night, I found myself with a gun in my hand, carjacking a man.
We're talking with R. Dwayne Betts. He was 16, skinny, a good student with a great mom. When, as he said, he held a gun for the first time to join a friend and stick a gun in a sleeping man's face and steal a car. He's written a book, A Question of Freedom, a memoir of learning, survival, and coming of age in prison. Recounts the 8 years that he spent in a series of Virginia prisons, mostly as an adult. Mr. Betts is now a graduate student at Warren Wilson College, a published poet, and teaches poetry at several schools in the Washington, D.C. area. Joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Let me take you back to that moment that changed your life, and I think it's fair to say, and this might be the point, the life of the man whose face you put the gun into. You pled guilty. But at the sentencing hearing, you apologized to the victim, but you blamed what happened on something else.
Well, during the sentencing, my family got up to speak for me, yeah. A lot of friends, and all of them got up and said that I did it because I didn't have a father in my life. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I felt I needed to do was one, apologize to the victim, yeah. But two, make it a point when I stood up in court to say I didn't commit this crime because I didn't have a father in my life. And I just really blamed it on a poor decision, an aberration. One night, I became someone else, and then in 30 minutes, everything changed.
Yeah. You were always a bright young man, but it seems like in prison, you discovered reading in a new way.
And this is the thing, though. People always tell me that I was bright, and I think I was bright. But when I tell people that I began to read in a different way in prison, I think what it is I began to really investigate what it was I was reading and have conversations about books with other people. And so it was at the point where a wide range of people who you wouldn't expect to be reading John Steinbeck was having a conversation about Easter Eden, mm-hmm. before it was on Oprah's Book Club. You know, we thought that we were the ones that made it an Oprah book instead of Oprah. So I think that's what changed this. In prison, I actually had the chance to have a conversation about what this book means, and what does it mean to me, and what does it mean in my life.
You read Nora Roberts.
I read everything, and I read Nora Roberts just because I needed some romance in my life, too. But the truth is, it was a good story, and I learned the importance of a well-written story from reading things like Nora Roberts and fantasy novels, things that, honestly, most of the students I went to college with and most of the professors might have really never thought to read. But yeah. It was good, and it got me from one day to the next.
You say in the book, I have seen things I will not recover from.
Yeah, I mean, that's... I was talking to one of my professors at Warren Wilson, and what came up in the conversation was that because I spent so much time in prison, mm-hmm. and all of my adult memories get funneled through the fact that I went to prison, I really can't recover from them because I can't move beyond them. I'm here today, and I should be happy, and it is a joyous moment for me. I wrote a book. I just graduated from college. But every minute, I know that part of the reason that I'm here is because the stories that I tell came from prison.
Yeah.
The desire to be a writer came from prison. And so I can never really fully recover from the things that I saw because I see them every day.
I'm going to risk pressing you a little bit on what you saw.
A lot of things stick out, but I would say this one story because I think it sort of captures the crazy that you could find in prison. Mm-hmm. Somebody yelled in the vent, this dude caught a body up here. And they had put an older white guy in a cell with this young black dude, and they had been having problems. The white guy moved out of the cell on his own twice, and the guards kept telling him to move back into the cell. So him and the guy started fighting. I saw the nurses carting the body off of the yard, but they was running, and I saw the nurse on a dude's chest trying to revive him. You know, I saw somebody get their head split open with a lock and a sock, over 8 stamps. To put all of this stuff together where it's just a collage of violence in my head. In a way, it's difficult to talk about it because, one, it didn't happen to me. So I sort of feel like I'm selling the pain of other people when I start telling all of these stories. Mm-hmm. But two, when I tell it, all of it mixes up into my head in just one blur of violence. And then I got to find a way to back away from it. It's even, I mean, and I think that's why in the book, I didn't want to focus as much on the violence, because I think the violence is what we already know. And the humanity is what we don't know about prisoners. And that's why the prison reform movement is so slow, because once you commit a crime, people have a hard time mm-hmm. thinking that you could redeem yourself.
There are a lot of people who hear an interview like this, and they might have some sympathy for you, but they get back to the fact that you were there because you harmed somebody.
Right.
And that you committed a crime and you caught me. In addition to that, you caused an innocent human being pain. And therefore, if you were scared, if you were hurt, you deserved it. You had it coming. And that's what locks people off from taking advice from someone who's been in prison.
And I understand that sentiment. What I say to the person that's saying that is, would you rather me come out of prison and be able to get a college degree and be able to volunteer in the community and be able to speak about ways in which prisoners can improve their lives so that they don't commit more crimes? Or would you rather I come out depraved? I come out haunted because someone raped me. So I say to the victim that I'm deeply regretful for what happened. And if I could do it all again, I wouldn't. But I can't go back to that moment. So at some point, I will hope that the whole world will give me the opportunity to redeem myself.
Dwayne Betts, author of the new book, A Question of Freedom. Mr. Betts, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Hurricane Bill is churning up in the Atlantic, heading north towards Canada and getting by Bermuda about this point. What else can we expect this year and why? Here to talk about it today is NOAA's lead hurricane forecaster, Jerry Bell. He is the, as I say, the seasonal hurricane forecaster, the lead for NOAA and the National Weather Service. Joins us from the Climate Prediction Center in Maryland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you back. Well, what is Bill up to?
Well, Bill is now weakening a little bit. It's a Category 2 storm, but don't let that be deceptive. It's still a very powerful, very big hurricane. And as Bill moves northward, it's expected to produce very high surf, anywhere from 8 to 14 feet, with the higher levels being Saturday and Sunday, along a lot of the East Coast. That is expected to then produce very strong rip currents and deadly rip currents. So people should be not, even though it's hot and muggy along the East Coast here, after this afternoon, be very careful about getting in the water, and certainly do not go in any beaches that are unsupervised or by yourself, because strong rip currents can kill you.
It seems that Bill is out there by Bermuda, way out in the Atlantic. Is that an unusual place to find a hurricane?
Most hurricanes have a track where they head up north of the Bahamas and then eventually curve to the north and then northeast. So, no, Bill is taking a typical track for a hurricane.
And it could hit Canada, is that correct?
That's possible, yes. Northeastern Canada, it could. It's still possible it could hit Canada as a hurricane. But our immediate concerns is, even though, as I mentioned, even though Bill is well out to sea, there anybody with maritime interests should be watching Bill, and also for just regular people,
yeah,
be very careful about going in the beach waters this weekend,
yeah,
if at all.
Yeah, because a lot of those Saturday surfers up here in the Northeast going to say, oh, wow, big waves. I'm going to get out there. And it's not a good thing to do. Let's talk about why does El Nino mean less tropical storms this year?
Well, El Nino is a climate phenomenon that refers to a warming of the ocean waters in the tropical Pacific Ocean along the equator. And you might say, well, how can something in the Pacific affect the Atlantic? Well, the warm waters from El Nino affect the wind patterns in the atmosphere far, far distant from the Pacific. And what they do is they act to increase the wind shear over the Atlantic Ocean, and that suppresses the Atlantic hurricane activity.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of lops off the top of the hurricanes?
That's right. Wind shear refers to how the wind speed and direction change as you go up through the atmosphere. If there's a strong change in wind speed and direction, which is what El Nino produces, that's called strong wind shear, that either will not allow hurricanes to form, or if they do form, can just rip them apart.
Yeah, so we're not expecting as many major hurricanes this year.
That's right. The NOAA's latest seasonal outlook that we issued on August 6th is calling for 1 to 2 major hurricanes. We've already got one with Major Hurricane Bill. We're all for the season expecting 3 to 6 hurricanes and 7 to 11 named storms.
Hmm. How do you make a prediction like that? What goes into your equation?
Well, it turns out that there's a couple of dominant climate factors that strongly control the wind and air pressure patterns over the Atlantic and therefore strongly control the overall strength of the hurricane season. One of those patterns is the tropical climate patterns that can last anywhere from 25 to 40 years at a time and are responsible for active hurricane eras, such as we've been in since 1995, and also lower activity eras. Mm-hmm. Another major climate factor is El Nino and its counterpart La Nina, which affect the season, the hurricane strength, season strength from 1 year to the next. And also we look at the Atlantic Ocean temperatures. And by analyzing and predicting and understanding the net effects of these three dominant climate factors, we can often estimate the strength of the hurricane season.
Can you tell us anything about individual storms? Does your prediction say that if we have a storm, it will be stronger or weaker this year?
Well, it does in terms of our predictions for how many systems might become hurricanes and how many might become major hurricanes. Uh-huh. But it does not, a seasonal forecast doesn't say anything about a specific event. Uh-huh. I think it's also important to point out that these outlooks really are a statement of the overall strength of the hurricane season. They're not a prediction of how many storms might strike the United States, mm-hmm. nor are they any indication of whether a particular locality might be affected. So regardless of the seasonal hurricane outlook, coastal residents should prepare each and every season for mm-hmm. the hurricane season.
Question coming in, a tweet coming in from SM Beaverson, who wants to know, what is the largest recorded hurricane?
The largest recorded hurricane in the Atlantic, they typically reach about 165 miles per hour. They're very powerful major hurricanes. The strongest hurricanes on the planet we tend to see in the western Pacific. Some of those strike China or Southeast Asia, and some of those storms can reach 180, 190 mile per hour mm-hmm.
so,
winds.
So Katrina was not the strongest hurricane on record.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But that brings up a good point that the hurricane strength is only one factor that determines the damage. Hurricanes cause damage from storm surge, winds, tornadoes, flooding, and in Katrina's case, destruction of the levees that led to subsequent flooding. So it's not just the strength of the hurricane that matters, and that's why I mentioned that although Bill is now Category 2, we're going to see the same impacts on the winds, whether it's technically a Category 2 or 3, doesn't matter.
How did they prepare in advance for a hurricane coming way before we had satellite pictures and things like that to let us know?
We didn't. Typically, before satellites and aircraft measurements back in the mid to late 1940s, people generally didn't know a hurricane was coming until it struck. And then you had these tremendous death tolls, Galveston, Texas, in the early 1900s and so on. Now with satellites and predictions and these seasonal forecasts, we can warn people, you know, and encourage people, have a preparedness plan in place. Mm-hmm. Think about how a hurricane might affect you, be it the storm surge or tornado or flooding. And then think about ways you can mitigate those impacts. We are now in the peak of the hurricane season. Coastal residents, you should already have your hurricane preparedness plan done. If you need to complete it, do so. Once a hurricane's approaching, it's too late to start thinking about what to do. You should already know what to do ahead of time, because we see time and time again that if you do have a plan and a hurricane threatens, you will be much better prepared than those that have not.
Jerry, as a hurricane scientist, I'm going to give you my blank check question. If you had a blank check and you could buy any piece of equipment or create a technology that would help you better to do your work in the hurricane business, what would you like? What do you need? What kind of technology would you like to have that you don't have?
That's hard to say because we have tremendous technologies that are currently brought to bear on the hurricane problem. We have global monitoring efforts. We can see the global weather patterns daily. We have excellent satellite capabilities to see these hurricanes. There's new satellite technologies being developed to even better estimate the winds and so on. But one of the best things we can do, and NOAA is heavily involved with this, is developing even better global observing systems, because with those improved systems, we can run better climate models and make even better seasonal predictions. And one place we'd like to go with this is to be able to make seasonal hurricane landfall forecasts. That capability just does not exist right now, but it would be that's something I look forward to potential in the future.
You mean to actually predict when a hurricane where it would land exactly?
Well, or to be more general in terms of to say, well, maybe this season we're predicting a certain strength, and by the way, we're expecting more of the hurricanes to, say, affect the Gulf Coast, or more maybe to affect Florida, or be able to say something about more potential local impacts.
A lot of people ask all the time whether we could do anything cloud seeding or any kind of technology to break up a hurricane or to mitigate it. Are we at that point?
My understanding is no. That's not my area of expertise, though.
Yeah, it's a pretty strong thing, a hurricane, isn't it?
Oh, tremendous. The smartest thing that we can do is, as a nation right now, is to understand that we are in an active hurricane era. We will continue to see high levels of hurricane activity for many years to come. And there is the threat of hurricanes striking the U.S. each and every hurricane season, regardless of its strength. The smartest thing that people can do is to have a plan ahead of time, evacuate if they're asked to do so, do simple things like don't go in the high surf this weekend and have your life potentially threatened. There's a lot that we can do to mitigate or reduce hurricane impacts, and we need to do them and better.
You know, when folks in the healthcare business or the flu season business want to know what the flu season may be like, they look at, you know, where it's winter now when the flu's happening, like in the southern hemisphere. Can you look at tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever the weather is in the southern hemisphere, and get any prediction of what it might happen in our season that comes up?
No, the main predictors for the seasonal hurricane strength are, as I mentioned, the El Niño-La Niña cycle, the Atlantic Ocean temperatures, and these long period patterns that produce active and inactive eras for anywhere from 25 to 40 years at a time. These are global climate patterns. They affect not just the Atlantic. We're interested in them for hurricane forecasts because they do affect the Atlantic, but they have global impacts, and we monitor and understand those as a matter of course.
What's the water temperature of the Gulf these days?
Well, the Gulf of Mexico is generally about 86 degrees Fahrenheit or so. The Gulf of Mexico reaches its peak temperatures during this time of the year.
Yeah, because I remember when everybody was focused on Katrina and those years of big hurricanes, we were talking over 90 degree temperatures there.
Sure, that's very warm water, and as we see, when hurricanes do get in the Gulf of Mexico, they can often strengthen considerably, partly because of the very warm water, and also partly because the wind shear tends to be low. Mm-hmm. And Gulf of Mexico systems are also a threat because there's nowhere to go but to make landfall.
Yeah. All right, Jerry, thank you very much for taking
thank
time
you,
to do
Ira.
This. And we'll see if we can heed those warnings that you're giving out. Jerry Bell is the lead seasonal hurricane forecaster for NOAA and the National Weather Service, and he was joining us from Climate Prediction Center at Camp Springs, Maryland.
When Don Hewitt, the longtime producer of 60 Minutes, died this week at the age of 86, I remember the time we were both invited to a conference organized by a journalism foundation to explore differences between television and newspaper reporting. At the first session, a publisher who was head of the Knight Ridder Corporation held up a mock newspaper front page containing the transcript of the CBS Evening News. It filled barely half a page. "See," he said, "take out the cornflakes and hemorrhoid cream commercials, and this is all the actual content you get on TV. But we give you this," he said, and thwacked a thick copy of his own daily paper triumphantly onto the table. When Don Hewitt took his turn, he showed a video. Local news anchors joshing and joking, weathermen clowning across cold fronts, and assorted local reporters riding tricycles and putting on fright rigs. "You know who those people are?" Don asked. He let a pause of silence and scattered nervous laughter build before he thundered. "They all work for television stations owned by Knight Ridder. They are your journalists. So get off your high horse," he told the publisher. "You get the chance to show us how to do something better every day, and you don't." A little later, over a drink, Don said that he liked the newspaper people, but they could be so sanctimonious, like they're different than us money grubbers in TV. "Well," he said, "I'm not ashamed to say that if I made shoes, I'd do it to make money, but I'd also make great shoes. I make a lot of money in television, but I also think I make some great TV." He sure did. Don Hewitt didn't try to disguise himself as a pillar of integrity. He was proud to be a master showman, and sometimes, to be sure, cast real, complex human beings as artificial heroes or villains for dramatic effect. But in a medium that is so often shrunk into sound bites, images, and half-sentences, he emphasized the power of narrative and good prose. Michael Gartner, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and publisher who now owns the Iowa Cubs, was also at that conference and said, "We run a newspaper to make money, but we make money to run a newspaper." Of course, today running any kind of news operation is not a promising way to make money. Audiences are in decline, deficits are on the rise. Publications that used to mock TV and tabloids as cheesy, unserious, and sensational now routinely put celebrity news and UFOs on their covers, and they still don't sell. But so many new media websites seem polemical and shrill. New media could often use some old storytelling talents, like Don Hewitt. You're listening to NPR News.